You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Engawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Arno. As part of 95BFM's election coverage this week on The Wire, we are focusing on human issues. Efi Akine coming up on the show, Amelia speaks to the Green Party's Chloe Swarbrick about student issues and how the Greens intend to help out students. Nicholas speaks to Stephen Judd from Fact Aotearoa and Nicole Skewes-Poole from the Disinformation Project about mis and disinformation in the lead up to the general election. And Arno, what have you got for us today?
I interviewed two union representatives, Sarah Thompson and Nicholas Main of ETU and First Union respectively, about fair pay agreements amidst workers striking across several industries. And I have a piece about the Work and Income New Zealand WINS funeral grant with Funeral Directors Association New Zealand Chief Executive Gillian Boys, who is campaigning for improved coverage and payment.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anu hi pakihere roki roki maurunga, i te pai tuku tuku, o Irirangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com, and you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Last year the inquiry into student wellbeing revealed a number of dire truths about the inequalities that students are facing, with the average student spending over half their income on rent. Among an increasing cost of living crisis, students are feeling the burn at the moment. So to get some insight into this issue and to find out how the Green Party wants to raise the standard of living for students, Amelia spoke to the Green Party spokesperson for tertiary education and the MP for Auckland Central, Chloe Swarbrick, and started by asking her about the state of student housing in Aotearoa.
Well, yeah, the findings from the People's Inquiry into student wellbeing were unfortunately shocking, but even more unfortunately not particularly surprising for anybody who's been paying attention to the state of things for students in this country over not only the past several years, but the past few decades. And it has always been really fascinating to me how there's been this narrative and rhetoric of student struggle or student poverty being a norm and naturalised and therefore seen by many as just a kind of thing to be taken for granted. But if you dig into the data, what you find is that the reality is that things are far harder and materially worse for students today than they were even 10 years ago, back when I was at uni. And one of the core drivers of that is not only the fact that student allowances haven't kept up with inflation and that means testing has not been removed, actually something that the Honourable Grant Robertson was campaigning for back when he was the head of NZUSA, but also those increases with regards to cost of living. And as we know from the kind of basket of goods and CPI inflation, that rent price increases are one of the key drivers of that. So the takeaway was 2/3 of students regularly cannot afford the basics. And as you allude to, one of the core reasons there is rent. But this is not something which is solely constricted to just students and their experience with the rental market. We know right now that, for example, 1 in 4 households that rent are already spending more than 40% of their income on housing costs, which is significantly above the common threshold for affordability of 30% of income, those international metrics. So long story short, it's bad, but it is not inevitable. It is the consequence of political decisions that have been made over the past few decades and held to this day. And that's why the Greens have been campaigning on our pledge to renters, because we know that we can arrest this terrible situation and the solutions are clearer than they ever have been.
Yeah, and last year's inquiry also found that a lot of students are faced with the decision to either go without basic necessities or have to miss class so they can work to pay for these necessities. What do you see as the main drivers of student inequality, and how do the Greens intend to address it?
Well, the core drivers are kind of just cost of living and cost of study, and that was laid bare in the People's Inquiry. And I guess just to give you some kind of background information on why we did the People's Inquiry, which was the largest collaboration that we've seen across student unions and associations in the past few decades, actually subsequent to at least the voluntary student membership changes that were brought into effect by the former National Act government, which wiped out the ability for our student unions to kind of plan meaningfully into the future and build sustainable campaigns, because their ability to generate resources were dashed. So the reason that we did that was because I had spent, you know, 5-6 years trying at Education Workforce Select Committee with hearings with the Tertiary Education Commission, with Universities New Zealand, with each of the tertiary institutions themselves, with the Ministry of Education and with MSD, to get an insight into what data they actually collected on the student experience, and particularly the associations to, for example, people dropping out. And we were hearing these challenges kind of quite profoundly throughout COVID-19. And what I was told time and again is that they simply weren't collecting that data, and therefore there was no issue, and therefore they didn't need to collect the data. But when I tried to put up propositions for doing an inquiry through the Select Committee lever, there wasn't any meaningful interest from the legacy parties of National or Labor. So we just decided to do it ourselves, and we did that with independent verification from the NADICators, who do a lot of polling and data collection. So it's all out there and available for everybody to see. But what we know is, again, that these circumstances, that the circumstance of student poverty, despite how normalised that might be in our kind of cultural rhetoric, is not an inevitability. It is the consequence of political decisions that have been made. So the Green solutions to it are incredibly clear. There were 5 recommendations in that People's Inquiry into student wellbeing. One was rent controls, others were universal student allowances, making public transport free, for example. And those are all things which are entirely feasible if the government decides to remove the rope that it's tied around its own hands behind its own back, that is through tax justice and implementing the likes of a wealth tax. So just be really clear on that. For the Greens, that looks like a universal student allowance of at least $385 per week, and those rent controls through the Pledge for Renters, which we've been campaigning on since our fully costed policy was released just a few weeks ago.
And so for the Green Party, would fees-free study for these qualifications ideally be the goal if we're in a perfect world?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, this is not something which is particularly far-fetched. It was the case that up until only a few decades ago, university was free and the majority of people who went were paid to be there. But through political decisions that have been made through the 80s, 90s and to this day, we have seen education continue to be farmed out and considered as an individual or private good. But just to kind of contextualise all of this and to give you kind of an insight into our thinking, you know, whenever you walk over a bridge or you walk into a building and it doesn't collapse, you are benefiting from somebody else's education. The fact that my appendix nearly burst a few years ago and I didn't die means that I have benefited from somebody else's education. The fact that people are able to understand the words that I am saying and you are saying on the radio right now means that people are benefiting from others' education. Education is a public good, and as a collective, as a country, as cities and towns across this country, all of us are better off when people have barrier-free access to education. And that's the point of going fees-free, because when removing that barrier to entry, but we're also removing that kind of burden of debt further into the future. And again, if you're going to make the argument that people may end up potentially earning more as a result of that tertiary level education, well, firstly, I'd say tell that to the social workers, to the teachers and the nurses who need their tertiary level qualifications, who are definitely not doing it for the glory or the money on the other side. But secondly, I'd say that if that is really your concern, that people may end up earning more at the other side of that qualification, then we can fix our tax system, because that means that we are removing that barrier to entry for those who come after.
And we're not really seeing much else from the other parties regarding their plans to address student inequality. Is this disappointing to see?
Look, I'd say that it's completely reflective of my experience over the past several years. I have tried and fought tooth and nail for there to be interest from the other political parties. I was alluding just earlier to how through Education and Workforce Select Committee, I have sought so hard to get cross-party consensus on kind of driving these issues forward. And so far, the only foothold that I managed to get was actually the huge mandate that we built around the issues with student accommodation that really came to the fore throughout the COVID-19 pandemic first hitting our shores in 2020. But look, case in point, in 2020, just prior to the government releasing its budget in around May, it knew that it was going to have to gear up to spend 10 times its operating allowance. We're talking billions and billions of dollars, setting itself up to do what became the likes of the wage subsidy and a range of other supports, the large-scale asset purchases through unconventional monetary policy, through the Reserve Bank and otherwise. And at that point in time, when it knew that it was going to be having to provide direct payments to particularly the most structurally marginalised New Zealanders in order to support all of us to get through, it simultaneously went back on its promise to reinstate postgraduate student allowance, which is a drop in the bucket of approximately $50 million per year. And it also went back on its promise to extend fees free into the second year. And if that doesn't tell you how little even a Labour party values students and student voice, I don't know what does. So I found complete disdain and lack of interest from across the parliament, bar the Greens, on this stuff over the past kind of 5-6 years, which I think is particularly egregious when you have politicians, not the least our Prime Minister and our Minister of Finance, who built their careers being leaders of student movements, arguing and advocating for precisely the things that they're now in a position of power to implement, but refusing to do so. And I guess that has to be a call to action for students across this country. There are 400,000 students studying at a tertiary level. That is enough votes to sway the direction of the next government, let alone to have that voice and that power felt in our parliament. And to give you a sense of context, there's only approximately 120,000 landlords in this country. But look at where the disproportionate power and policy flows. And that tells you that politics belongs to those who turn up. So my kind of plea to students is to recognise that while I completely understand you only get this transient window of typically between 3 to 5 years into that hardship, things have been getting worse and worse and degrading more and more when you look at timescales of 10 plus years. And there is the opportunity to use that power to make sure that things are not only better for you now, but for those who come after you. So please, for the love of God, don't only vote, but don't leave politics to the politicians.
That was Amelia speaking to the Green Party's Chloe Swarbrick.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
The Work and Income New Zealand Funeral Grant is a payment that those eligible can receive to help pay for funeral costs. The amount paid has not changed in 20 years and has been criticised as being too low, not even covering the costs of a basic cremation. The Funeral Directors Association New Zealand is campaigning for increased payments and coverage to give those dying and their loved ones dignity. I spoke to Chief Executive Gillian Boyes about the WINS Funeral Grant and their campaign. I started our interview by asking how much the current grant is worth and how this number came about.
The Wire. Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
Okay, so the current amount it's worth is $2,445.37. That amount was landed on about 20 years ago when the government last reviewed the WINS grant amount, and then it's just gone up with CPI adjustments ever since, so that's why it's a bit of a funny amount.
Is the WINS funeral grant enough to cover a basic funeral?
No, look, we have looked at that. We've looked across the country at the prices of funerals, and we think for a basic funeral with a cremation, it's probably around the $7,500 mark, and for a burial, maybe around $10,000. So, you know, you can see that the grant at best pays at about a third of the cost of that cremation funeral, so really nowhere near enough.
How often is the WINS grant used?
There's about 5,000 New Zealanders every year that rely on the WINS grant, so, and that's out of about 34,000-35,000 deaths. So around about 19%, I think, I worked out, of people rely on that grant. So it's relatively high usage.
How easy is it to get a WINS grant for funeral costs?
Well, it is a process. So you need to fill out a very comprehensive form. You need to drop it into a WINS office because you can't email it. You need to provide supporting documents like a death certificate or proof of death and bank statement at the day the person died. You need to provide proof of your assets and income. So there's quite a lot to it, and that's quite hard for a grieving family to navigate, particularly if they are quite poor and perhaps don't have access to things like computers where they could print off a bank statement.
What is the Funeral Directors Association asking the government for?
Well, the association is asking the government to increase the grant amount. We don't think the amount enables families to have a good choice when it comes to making their funeral arrangements. We'd like to see it go up to nearer $7,000, which is what the ACC pay if you die in an accident for a funeral grant. So ACC pay $7,400. So we think if it were near that $7,000 mark, you'd actually be able to let the family have some choices about having a small ceremony or, you know, potentially having a burial if they can come up with a bit more money. And those choices aren't available to some families at the moment.
Are you also asking for improved coverage, like for the death certificate?
Yes, so there are some things that are and aren't covered in the grant, and ironically the death certificate isn't one of those. There's also some funny things like it will cover the burial plot, but it won't cover the cost to dig the plot, and that's a compulsory charge by the council, usually another $1,000 or so. There's costs that just seem a bit odd that aren't covered. So we would like to see the government look at the criteria and just make it a bit more reasonable and fit for purpose.
Have any political parties made a promise to improve the WINS funeral grant?
No, unfortunately they haven't. We've talked to a number of political parties. They're sympathetic. I guess they're juggling a lot of welfare needs, and we've had quite a few promises from the current minister that the welfare review would consider this, but we're seeing that the recommendations from that review are acting at a real glacial pace. So we're not very optimistic that it will come about through there. So we'd really like someone in government to actually focus on this and give it some attention, because you know, people are missing out at a time when they're having the greatest period of grief ever, and it just seems so desperately unfair.
That was Funeral Directors Association NZ Chief Executive Gillian Boyce on the WINS funeral grant.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
And we'll be back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
We'll be right back. Wow. Music's everywhere. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them in a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The September playlist has blossomed and will put a spring in your step. Featuring Juju Lips, Blunt Dog, Deep State, Swallow the Rat, DC Maxwell, Mermaidens and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Auckland's favourite summer festival is back for 2024.
That's right. St. Jerome's Laneway Festival is here. Happening at Western Springs on Waitangi Day, Tuesday, February 6th.
And as always, they have stacked the chilli bin chock-a-full of the coolest local and international musical acts. Featuring
Stormzy,
Steve Lacey,
Dominic Fike,
Unknown Mortal Orchestra,
AJ Tracy,
David,
Dope Lemon,
iDress,
Faye Webster,
Horse Girl,
Near Archives,
Paris, Texas,
Pretty Girl,
Ray,
Skin on Skin,
Suki Waterhouse,
Atsurangi,
Blonde Shell,
Church,
Daily J,
Dommy and JD Beck,
Ernie Bell,
Hundy,
Hemlock Springs,
and Molly Payton.
St. Jerome's Laneway Festival 2024.
Waitangi Day, Tuesday, February 6th. Last year, the tickets sold out in record time, so sign up for pre-sale access now via lanewayfestival.com.
I haven't voted before because I feel like my voice isn't heard.
But I'm not the only one.
If we all had a say
on the issues that matter to us
and our communities,
that'll be powerful, right?
Yep.
Let's make our voices heard by voting in this year's general election.
Brought to you by the Electoral Commission.
Ow, my back!
What happened?
I slept on the floor.
Why?
I don't know how to wake up on the right side of the bed. Is it my right side or my left side?
Always wake up on the right side with the 95BFM wake-up call. Tune in at 7:25 on Breakfast with Rachel for your chance to win a voucher for 6 coffees, thanks to Atomic. Just text the word Atomic and your B-card number to 5395 to go in the draw. The 95BFM wake-up call, thanks to Atomic Coffee Roasters.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. In 2020, NetSafe released a report that revealed more than 50% of New Zealanders admitted to falling for fake news stories online. As disinformation is becoming more prevalent, there are fears surrounding the impact that misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theories could have in our upcoming election. Nicholas spoke to Stephen Judd from Fight Against Conspiracy Theories Aotearoa, Fact Aotearoa, about the spread of conspiracy theories in New Zealand. He started off their interview by asking about how Fact began and what their mission is.
FACT stands for Fight Against Conspiracy Theories, and that pretty much sums up what we're about. We try to counter the harmful conspiracy theories and misinformation. Some of what we do is by monitoring online activity to see what's floating around out there. We create educational resources, and sometimes we do awareness type campaigns as well. We're made up of mostly volunteers, in fact entirely volunteers. FACT first started I think in late 2020, the run up to the previous general election, with a group of people who are just really concerned about the anti-vaccination and COVID misinformation that was gaining traction at that time. As people who spread misinfo have kind of moved on and moved out from just anti-vax stuff, so have we.
Who are the people who are most vulnerable in our society to being misinformed into thinking and believing that conspiracy theories are real?
That's a really good question. There's not a single clear-cut answer to that. It's often got a lot more to do with what's going on in people's lives than what kind of person they are in society. So often it's people who are feeling vulnerable for some other reason, economically vulnerable, loss of social status, something going on in their personal life. And if they get connection, emotional connection to some of these ideas or to a person who's sympathetic to them but spreading those ideas, then they might be a little bit less sceptical than they otherwise would be, and that's when they become vulnerable. So, you know, you would be surprised. There are really intelligent, qualified people who subscribe to really out there conspiracy theory, and there are people who are not well educated and not well off who nonetheless are hard-headed and sceptical and have a lot of common sense. Now, you can't generalise about this. It's much more about the sense of vulnerability and the need to explain a sense that something is wrong. You could have a look at the kinds of people who turned up to the protests at Parliament last year, you know, the vast bulk of whom subscribed to one kind of conspiracy theory or another. And those people came from a lot of different backgrounds, some of them quite privileged, some of them quite disadvantaged. But a common theme for a lot of them was that they felt that they had been hurt or that their position in life had been destabilised by the measures that the government had taken in the previous year. And that, as much as anything else, was driving their that, as much as anything else, was motivating them.
What are the most common tactics or ways of spreading conspiracy theories in New Zealand?
The biggest... Okay. I think there are two principal channels. You know, one is online, especially through Facebook as a big vector, or even through good old-fashioned email, particularly among older people, and through online video. You know, sometimes YouTube, but also trying to get people, TikTok, anything that serves video content. Surprisingly, perhaps, another really big method is face-to-face recruitment. So Voices for Freedom place big emphasis on inviting potential members to gatherings and getting them to meet people. And gently persuading them, like they encourage their members to try and persuade their families and friends, you know, one-on-one, face-to-face. So I see that as really effective.
You touched on Voices of Freedom there. The election is coming up. Has FACT seen any examples of conspiracy theories around politics in the lead-up to this election that are particularly concerning?
Yes, we have. So one thing that's worth noting, So FACT has seen that Voices for Freedom and the Freedom and Rights Coalition have both urged their members to try and seek employment with the Electoral Commission in the run-up to the election if they are concerned about election integrity. And so the reason that they're doing that is because they are hinting to their members that our elections don't have integrity or wouldn't unless they were personally involved. And that's because people at the fringes of those organisations have taken their cue from the United States and other places where defeated politicians just claim the election was stolen. And they're kind of laying the groundwork for similar claims here that our elections are in some way untrustworthy or manipulated. So, you know, what you might call election fraud theory is out there and circulating.
You spoke about there, you know, some other tactics that conspiracy theorists are using. So I want to ask you what resources are available to people who do want to combat conspiracy theories in their own families and communities?
Okay, good question. But one thing I'll point out, so FACT Aotearoa on our website has been publishing some resources that address some of the more common ideas that these people are spreading. We've got a little special section on our website for the 2023 election that collects some of those things. That includes a guide for people running public events who don't want them disrupted the way that we've seen events being disrupted in the last few weeks. We think that's only going to get worse. Unfortunately, there's very little out there to support people whose friends or families or close connections have really bought into conspiracy theories. We wish that there was, but there isn't. There are online groups on Reddit and Facebook that kind of provide peer support, like a support group, but there's no kind of official service or organised service to help people. Probably the best thing you can do, to be honest, is try and maintain the relationship. You know, we talked earlier about who becomes vulnerable, and we said that was, you know, people who are in a psychological state where they are feeling under threat for one reason or another. And that means that those people didn't reason their way into believing a conspiracy theory. They didn't kind of like make a logical assessment about facts and then go, aha, I agree with this. They felt their way in there. And so they're not going to be argued out, right? You're not going to, because that's not how they got there. And they're not going to be persuaded out. They kind of have to make that decision for themselves when they maybe look around and see the effect this has had on their lives, or they come to the conclusion they were wrong themselves. And at that point, there needs to be somebody that they can talk to help them get out. Because one of the things that happens when people really go down the rabbit hole, they often burn away their friends and contacts and support networks, and those support systems are replaced by fellow believers in conspiracy theory. So they can get to a point where they've got doubts and they're not sure that they're where they should be, but they don't have anyone to turn to anymore because they got rid of all those people, and the conspiracy theory fellow believers are their only friends now. So the biggest value you can have is like still being around to be a friend and provide a route out. People who believe in conspiracy theories are not going to be persuaded by me lecturing them about what's right and wrong. They're going to find it a lot easier to talk to someone they know and trust. And that has to be you.
Next, Nicholas spoke to the Disinformation Project's Nicole Skews-Poole about their mahi and who is vulnerable to disinformation.
We were founded 3 years ago for the purposes of looking at COVID disinformation. So in those early days of the pandemic, we knew that people were starting to get some really bad information online. And so the Disinformation Project was stood up to look into that and kind of analyse what we were seeing and make recommendations to decision makers about how to mitigate potential harms from online mis and disinformation. Disinformation is false information that is spread deliberately. Misinformation is false information that someone believes to be true and is sharing it with good intent. But when bad information is shared at scale, the impacts tend to be the same as disinformation, which is that people are getting bad and harmful and increasingly kind of extreme views based on false information. And so what we see with our kind of last 3 years has been that it originally started, as I said, with those sort of groups that were formed around COVID disinformation. And then within those networks, they both grew and expanded their own membership and also grew and expanded into other disinformation-based ideas. And so, you know, groups that might have originally started on one topic now have grown to include a whole bunch of different disinformation themes and topics.
You spoke there about disinformation being targeted and being purposefully spread. So are there any particular demographics or groups in our society that are the most targeted or more susceptible to disinformation?
Being targeted by and being susceptible to are kind of different areas. We know that disinformation preys on existing biases that people might hold, and that they often kind of continue the marginalisation of marginalised groups. So, for instance, the co-governance stuff that's happening at the moment is a really key theme in disinformation groups. So the belief that, you know, there are elite Māori that seek to take away people's rights through sort of co-governance and small gains towards treaty justice, and that's just not true. We also see trans people being targeted increasingly, and obviously the sort of impact on them is already, you know, they are already communities that experience disproportionate harm in society and have poor health outcomes, and so disinformation only seeks to exacerbate those kind of issues, unfortunately. The people themselves that can get sucked in by disinformation can be quite a diverse group of people. But we know that, you know, particularly in the early days of the pandemic, a key thing that led people to go and find these groups online or, you know, consider joining because they knew their friends were in them or whatever, was actually just a sense of fear and isolation and uncertainty. And sometimes these kind of disinformation views and this conspiratorial thinking that it supports can have kind of nice, clean, black and white thinking that helps people feel like they understand some really complex issues that are happening, like an international pandemic, you know? And so they're kind of looking for answers, but the answers that they're getting from these groups, unfortunately, are completely false.
The thing about we're living in a more globalised society, and the advent of the internet has definitely accelerated our globalisation. So I wanted to ask a little bit about the internet and its role in disinformation. So what the main avenues are that are used online in order to spread disinformation.
So we see a lot of communities that are based around Telegram channels. Increasingly, those kind of what we would consider more niche or more alternative media subscribers are coming back to Twitter, because the rights and responsibilities and content moderation on that platform has completely changed in the last several months. There are still some groups on Facebook, and there are other more niche channels similar to Telegram that are kind of, you know, off-brand versions of big group chats that have their own app.
For people who have, or people who think that family members have been caught up in disinformation, what are some resources that are available to them to help combat that?
The Disinformation Project, we're a research group, so we look at the landscape of disinformation in Aotearoa and how it's playing out and what the key things are and who the key influencers are and how that's impacting social cohesion. We don't provide kind of personalised services for individuals who have gone down that kind of conspiratorial rabbit hole, because those people have gone down for a variety of different reasons, and the kind of safety net that needs to come up underneath them and help them out is quite different for each person. But we know that the things that prevent disinformation are already part of our society. So good journalism, trusted sources of information, good kind of media literacy and critical thinking about what we see online and not just immediately believing something that someone sent us. And those things, as I say, are all already kind of parts of society. They just might be parts that we're not really valuing at the moment. So, you know, we see, unfortunately, some really significant cuts to the humanities across different universities in New Zealand at the moment, and things like cultural history and sociology and things that help us kind of understand the reasons why people believe different things and the histories behind them. Those are really important toolkits in understanding and combating disinformation. So it's really disheartening to see universities not value those classes and those lecturers and the people with those skill sets as the important resources that they are.
Has there been any themes or areas that you believe have become susceptible to disinformation, or any examples that you've seen of disinformation being spread around this upcoming election?
I mean, heaps. There's just been, this will probably be the first election in New Zealand that has had such a huge disinformation theme flowing through it. And so that ranges from, you know, people standing up their own political parties based on disinformation, or sort of more mainstream candidates taking up disinformation-based views and trying to mainstream them. Something that we've also seen is groups that are based on disinformation really starting to encourage their followers to go and disrupt democratic processes. So, you know, we've seen people try and get roles at the Electoral Commission. We've seen people talking about how their members need to go down to any and all candidates' forum and just sort of shut it down and disrupt that sort of process of the important process of democracy, where people can ask candidates, you know, things you know, straight to their face, those kind of fantastic community church hall events that people go down to and ask questions for are increasingly becoming sites of some really nasty stuff. And that's quite different from the kind of normal heckling of politicians that we would see, or the really justified use of disruption and protest to sort of make a political point. These are bad actors who are encouraging provably false ideas in order to kind of undermine people's belief in the electoral system and the candidates that seek to represent them. And some of those candidates are also leaning into that and benefiting from those views and sort of position themselves as a friend to those groups and those people.
That was Stephen Judd from Fight Against Conspiracy Theories Aotearoa, and Nicole Skews Poole from the Disinformation Project speaking to Nicholas about conspiracy theories, misinformation and disinformation in the lead up to the general election.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler.
You're right. Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's...
Botica Beats with Enrique Morales, Miguel BD and Gustavo Ferreira with support from DJ Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow...
Panimals Live, followed by Marjorie Sinclair, Luca and Spliff Curtis.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Hey, I hope everyone's keeping cool out there.
Auckland City's favourite summer festival is coming back for 2024. That's right, Laimea returns to Western Springs on Waitangi Day.
How's everyone doing?
To get that hype train rolling, Johnny and Corey will be playing some uber-rare live recordings from Laimea's past every day this week on 95 BFM Drive.
I hope you're keeping cool. It's pretty warm.
So pull out your special festy hat and set your dreams for summer.
Laimea Live, all this week, only on 95 BFM Drive.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Cleaners at Auckland Airport are going on strike to protest a pay increase of zero this year. They are also campaigning for a fair pay agreement, a process where unions work with companies to ensure fair pay for union members. Etu Union is the biggest private sector union in New Zealand, representing workers from dozens of industries. I spoke with Director Sarah Thompson to find out more about fair pay agreements and how they function. Here is that piece now. Why were the airport cleaners going on strike, and how long is this action expected to take?
The workers at the airport, the cleaners there went on strike because their company is currently offering them a 0% increase on their minimum wage. So these workers worked really hard. Some of them have been at the airport for over 20 years and we've been in bargaining, and all the company is offering is minimum wage, no increase, 0%.
What is a fair pay agreement and why do the airport cleaners want one?
Well, the fair pay agreement is kind of a solution almost to the problem that we're having in bargaining. These companies, they're all competing with each other to be able to charge out their services at lower and lower costs. And so what that means is like a race to the bottom on the workers' wages. So a fair pay agreement means that we can go and negotiate an agreement that covers all cleaners across the whole country and bring up those standards through new minimum standards and conditions. So this is a way to level the playing field and make sure that all of these cleaning companies are paying a decent wage and have good health and safety standards and opportunities for development.
What tangible benefits would a fair pay agreement have for workers who are in one, especially those affected by the high cost of living and so on?
Definitely. I mean, for the fair pay agreements, once it's negotiated, so we won't get to head into negotiations for the cleaners FPA until potentially late this year, early next year. In the agreement have to be things like penal rates, so any kind of overtime rates. You have to have your pay rates in there. We'll be negotiating for a living wage, which is the amount people need to be able to live on. There'll also have to be stuff in there around health and safety, which will be particularly good for cleaners who use lots of chemicals. But mostly what it's going to do is just lift those standards, so no matter which cleaning company they go and work for, these workers will know what they're going to get paid.
National and ACT have promised to scrap fair pay agreements. Why is this, and is this good or bad?
Yes, they want to scrap them, and I think the answer to why they want to scrap them is pretty obvious, and that's because fair pay agreements will take money out of the pockets of businesses and it will put the money in the pockets of the workers. And these are workers who are on minimum wage and they deserve more. So National and ACT want to scrap fair pay agreements because they're not good for their business buddies and they're good for workers. And that's as simple as it is. And so we need everybody to get out and vote this election to make sure that we get a party that will keep things like fair pay agreements, won't bring in terrible things like 90-day laws like what National and ACT are proposing. So it's just clear. National and ACT are anti-worker, and that's why they want to get rid of fair pay agreements.
What is the 90-day rule that you were referring to?
So at the moment, we used to have 90-day laws, so you could employ somebody and then within 90 days, for whatever reason, you could dismiss them. This was removed under Labor, and National wants to bring it back. So it means that people have high levels of insecurity in their job. They don't know whether they're going to keep that job past the 90 days. It forces people to take jobs, any job, on lower rates and lower conditions, and just pushes them into insecurity. It's not been shown to have any increase in terms of how many people are employed or how much longer they stay in the job, or that the people that you take on the 90-day trials are people who would otherwise not be in work. So it just pushes people into this cycle of insecurity, job after job, without knowing, you know, where their money's going to come from in 90 days.
Next, I spoke with First Union organizer Nicholas Main. Last week on Friday, workers at the warehouse took strike action, protesting a low wage and dangerously low staffing levels in store. I set out to find out more about the strike and what can be done going forward to improve conditions for low-paid workers. Here is that piece now. What were the warehouse workers striking about?
So the warehouse workers were striking for better staffing ratios and a living wage.
What is a collective agreement and how does the warehouse participate in one?
So a collective agreement is an employment agreement that's negotiated between union members and their employer. In New Zealand, we have two types of employment agreement, with a third that's just come in last year called a fair pay agreement. But the two main types are individual employment agreements and collective employment agreements. Collective employment agreements are a situation where a union, being it's all its union members, will negotiate collectively with their employer for better rights and conditions. And the advantage of a collective employment agreement is you've got a whole lot of rights attached to that that allow you to work cooperatively, such as the right to take industrial action, and even the right to seek mediation or arbitration around the settlement of that agreement to try and reach agreement without necessarily having to take industrial action.
What's the difference between a fair pay agreement and a collective agreement, and does the warehouse engage in a fair pay agreement?
So a fair pay agreement, it's a new form of collective employment agreement that was introduced last year. It's very similar to the old industry awards that we used to have prior to 1991. And it's an agreement that covers the entire industry. Now, there are no fair pay agreements planned at the moment for department stores. The closest fair pay agreement that's currently being in the process of getting ready to be negotiated is for supermarket workers. But until such time as a number of other fair pay agreements have been settled, the warehouse workers and other department store workers will have to settle for being covered by collective employment agreements.
How does low pay and the high cost of living affect the livelihood of union members?
Well, it has some serious impacts on them. I know one worker I was talking to who has a son with a heart condition, and was talking about the fact that in the past she's had to take on boarders in order to keep the bills being paid, and how concerned she felt around that in terms of the safety of her family, given that these are people she didn't always know very well that she was having to let into her house in order to help pay the bills. So, you know, in any situation where you've got low wages, you've got workers trying to do their best to try and survive off that, and they make choices that aren't always best for their families' situations they put in order to do that.
Finally, what advice do you give to members when voting?
Well, the advice we're giving to members at the moment is that this is an agreement that they shouldn't agree to. 2 years ago, the warehouse agreed to paying all workers after 1 year of service a living wage rate. They weren't signed up as a living wage employer, but they agreed to pay the same rate as the living wage after 1 year of service. And in exchange for that, they negotiated away some other terms and conditions of employment. So when we look at this offer, it's almost $1.50 less than the living wage after 1 year of service. And that's a massive pay cut in real terms for workers. So the advice is very clear. You deserve to at least be paid the same in real terms as you were 2 years ago. Therefore, you should reject this offer.
Are there any political parties that are promising to address things like fair pay agreements that you know of?
Well, both fair pay agreements are a Labor Party policy, and certainly the union is in favour of maintaining a government that supports fair pay agreements, as opposed to governments that want to remove them. So any party that's going to support a wider coalition involving Labor is certainly going to be one that we would recommend.
That was Sarah Thompson of Etu Union and Nicholas Main of First Union on fair pay agreements and workers striking in different industries.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mō tēnei wiki nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Chloe Swarbrick, Nicole Skews-Poole from the Disinformation Project, Stephen Judd from Fact Aotearoa, Gillian Boyes from the Funeral Directors Association NZ, Sarah Thompson from Etu Union, and Nicholas Main from First Union. Ni ra hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge.
When I get to work, I get to work.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.